Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Lance Allred had a lot of things going for him when he decided that he'd like to play pro basketball. He was 6 feet 11 inches tall, and that can't be taught. Fundamentals and team play can be taught, though, and Allred had learned those things from a smart and sensitive high school coach. On the other hand, Allred is deaf, and for years his life was complicated by his obsessive-compulsive disorder, and then there was the business about his first college coach insulting and ridiculing him. In Long Shot, the adventures of a deaf fundamentalist Mormon kid and his journey to the NBA, Lance Allred provides his life story. When we spoke recently, I asked him about his early years in the polygamist commune in Montana where he grew up and where a Sunday school teacher told him that God had sent him into the world deaf because he had not sided with the Lord against Satan in an earlier incarnation. I wondered whether this was an explanation Lance and his family had accepted.
I actually never really talked to my parents about that because, you know, part of you believes that it's not true. That's a lie, you know. But also, when you're at the age of 5 or 6, you're very impressionable to positions of authority. Compared to other religious extremes, the Allred group was definitely more moderate because my grandfather, Rulin, who had founded the Allred group, was actually a medical doctor, so we were allowed to go outside and get work elsewhere if we needed to. But, you know, I remember I didn't have my first interaction with a black man, probably at least until I was in my young teens.
Eventually, you and the members of your immediate family left the polygamist commune into which you were born. What were the circumstances of that departure?
There were two headquarters for the Allred group, one in Montana and one in Salt Lake City, about an hour outside of Salt Lake City. I lived in Montana till I was 6, and my father got in a tussle with some of the leaders up there because my father had decided to stand up for my mom's younger sister, and it got pretty ugly. And my father decided it was time to leave, but he could not yet totally separate himself from the Allred group because, you know, it's hard to let go of the idea that you're special. Mm. Imagine growing up believing that your father is a prophet and he is going to get you into heaven. And so it wasn't until I was 12 and we were living in Salt Lake City that my father actually had found himself in a pretty vital position in the Allred group. And my father had become privy to lots of information and discovered that several men who we called apostles, leaders of the group, had been raping and molesting their kids for years. And I was the youngest of 5, and I was 12, but all of us knew it was time to go. And luckily we could go because my father only had one wife, my mother, but also my father was able to put the safety of his own children ahead of his own fragile ego, and I have a lot of admiration for that because a lot of people can't cut their losses. My father, at the age of 42, was able to say, my whole life has been a lie except for I have a wonderful marriage and 5 wonderful kids, and that's enough for me.
At the point when your family's life did change, you were 12 years old. Basketball hadn't really come into the equation at that point. At what point did the game begin to be an important part of your life?
Right at the time as we left, my father's side of the family completely disowned us. My mother's side stayed very close, but my father's side disowned us, and I lost all my cousins, all my best friends. At that age, though, I also was carrying a lot of indoctrination and guilt in my head. And I remember I just started having these weird, what I know now as obsessive compulsive thoughts, and my compulsion would be to pray, and I believe in a very angry, broody God. And at that time, in 8th grade, I grew from 5'10 to 6'4". And everyone in my new school was like, hey, you're really tall. You should come play. And so I went and tried out for the team, and I was awful. Trust me, I was just awful, awful. But hey, I had really, really good fine motor skills in that I was a monster at Nintendo. I'll give you that much. And but as far as the athletic field of things go, I was not very good. But I liked the sense of camaraderie. I liked belonging to something and being able to invest in something greater than myself and having teammates that I could commit to. And not wanting to embrace cliche, my weakness of OCD and perfectionism would also become my greatest strength, and that would always demand perfection of myself, and that's why I kept getting better and better. And ironically, I wanted so badly to be normal through basketball that I actually became pretty good at it, that I was no longer normal anymore.
Pretty good, maybe something of an understatement for somebody who did make the NBA. But you write about lots of times when your deafness had an impact on your life as an athlete. But one particular encounter with an official struck me as especially unfortunate. Tell us the story of the day you were playing in the Junior Jazz Recreation League and personally handed the other team, I don't remember exactly how many technical foul shots.
Yeah, I remember it was 10 seconds left in the game. This is my first year playing basketball, and I wasn't familiar with all the rules. And we were standing at the free throw line. We were up by one, and the other team was shooting free throws. And back in the mid-90s, it was really cool to hold your hands up during a free throw. And I was playing without my hearing aids, and I've never been able to play a basketball game with my hearing aids in because all the noise around me just overwhelms my hearing aids and it shuts it down, especially now with all the loud arenas that I play in with the jumbotrons and everything. I can't play with my hearing aids in. And I was holding my hands up, and all of a sudden the ref just blew a whistle, and I was so confused, and we all had to step off, and the kid got to shoot two free throws. And then he went up and shot again. We all lined up. The ref blew another one on me and then ejected me. And I guess he was talking to me, but I wasn't looking at his face, and so I couldn't read his lips and see what was going on. And then after the game, my father went up and talked to the ref, and he goes, "Excuse me, sir, what happened? What did my son do to deserve the calls?" And the ref says, "Oh, that little kid was just a stuck-up brat. I mean, he was telling him to not hold his hands up, and he was just ignoring me. I mean, he was just..." And then my father says, "Excuse me, sir, you probably didn't know he wasn't looking at you. He's deaf." And my father held up my hearing aids, and the ref just went white and then said a word that I probably can't repeat on the air.
You felt that you had just the right high school coach at East High in Salt Lake City. Kerry Rupp knew how to develop your potential and, more important, how to encourage you. Would it be fair to say that when you decided to go to the University of Utah, you found yourself with just the wrong college coach in Rick Majerus?
Just the right coach in that he was a brilliant X and O man. He is. But I can't say Rick Majerus was any more brutal to me than the next player. But my emotional makeup mixed with his criticism was just a recipe for disaster.
The specificity of his brutality to you, though, seemed to me extraordinary. You write that Rick Majerus accused you of using your hearing impairment as a way to, quote, weasel your way through life. And according to you, he said, I'm quoting now, "You're a disgrace to cripples, and if I were in a wheelchair and saw you play basketball, I'd shoot myself." Did that outburst surprise you?
It didn't surprise me, but at that point, you know, I knew I was done because he had beaten me so far to the ground after 2 years of playing for him at that point that I was basically an emotional zombie. Like, I wasn't talking to anybody anymore. I wasn't feeling anything. I wasn't sleeping. But, you know, at this point today, if someone were to say that to me, I would just laugh because it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard anyone say. I mean, but at the time, it got me, and I knew I just couldn't play for this man anymore. But because I'm able to accept accountability for my shortcomings at Utah, I can also give Majerus no credit for my future success as well.
You finished your college career at Weber State. How did the years there differ from the years when you were playing at Utah?
I played for Joe Cravens. He at one time had been an assistant for Coach Majerus. Really trying to describe just the absurd settings you found yourself in under Rick Majerus is like trying to describe the Grand Canyon to someone who's never been there. I mean, they're like, "No, that couldn't happen." I'm like, "No, you really just have to be there to believe it." So Cravens was very sympathetic to that, but he also was the only Division I coach who offered me a scholarship. He also was very patient with me because at that time, my OCD tendency started to really break out because my facade of basketball had broken down so much and I wasn't playing that year that I couldn't hide through basketball anymore. So therefore, it started to creep out through relationships or schoolwork. And I went on medication, and Coach Cravens was very patient with me through that process, and I'll always be grateful. And a lot of times I became very reactionary because I had put up with so much abuse at Utah for 3 years that I was like, you know, I'm just going to stick it to the man. So I became pretty tough to handle for Coach Cravens sometimes. And as he would like to say, trying to coach me sometimes was like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall.
As it turned out, your professional career started with you playing in Europe. Now, just as a reality check for any listeners who may think playing pro basketball in Europe is all glamour and glory, please describe your first experience as a pro.
Oh, boy. I went and played in Turkey, in Istanbul, and it sounds wonderful. It sounds like a fairy tale, but it's not. Just because you sign a contract in Europe, they say it's guaranteed through injury and whatnot, but all it really means is this is the most money that we're going to be paying you.
What a great contract.
Yeah. And so I signed a contract in Turkey, a $90,000 contract for a rookie is actually a pretty good deal. You know, I got there in the first 2 weeks, I was playing really well. You know, everything was going well, but then a couple guys came back from injury, and then they signed a point guard. A good guy, but he was a shoot first point guard, and I'm a structure type basketball player, and when you're playing on a team with a shoot first point guard, I'm basically just useless. For like 3 straight weeks, they kept bringing in other big guys to practice against me. Each time they thought this guy is going to, you know, take my job, he has a really good resume, and I would just destroy him in practice, and then they would send him home. But then finally the break came when one day I showed up to join the team on a preseason road tournament, and I showed up, and the bus was gone. And I got a text message saying from the coach, Lance, I'm really sorry. And then the next day, I had a plane ticket home. That's just the way it goes.
And my understanding is that team in Turkey still owes you some money.
Oh, yeah. They owe me about $70,000. But what am I going to do? You know, I'm not a citizen of that country. I don't have any rights. And so that just goes to show there's a lot of shady dealings in Europe, and it's a business.
Eventually, you found your way to the NBA's Development League, which the most fortunate players can use as a ladder to the NBA. Your stories about the guys you found yourself rooming with in your first year in the D-League may surprise some readers.
Well, you know, stereotypes are stereotypes for a reason because they're mostly true. I got put in a 3-bedroom apartment with 2 other guys. I mean, they were good guys, but we just had different lifestyles. And they would like to come home at 4 o'clock in the morning the night before a game with various partners on different nights and smoke dope and keep me awake and give me sinus infections because of all that smoke. And, you know, it wasn't because of a moral sense. But, you know, it definitely was a tough challenge. After that first season in Europe, I came home from that knee injury in Spain, and the team wouldn't pay for it, and I had to pay for my own knee surgery, and I was broke. I had no money, and I was about to quit and move on, but then I decided to give it one last shot in the D-League, and there I was in the D-League making $15,000, and it's not helping my debt any, and it's like, you know, what is this all for? My teammates are smoking dope next door, and I can't sleep, and I'm broke, and, like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. Eventually, within 1 week, the starting power forward got his contract bought out, ironically, to the same team in Turkey that owes me money. And I'm like, hey, God bless you. If they pay you, I hope it works out for you. And then the starting center broke his leg, and the assignment center got recalled back to Seattle. And by default, I became the starting center. And within that first week, I had a 30-point game, and everyone was like, hey, where did this guy come from? But it was so late towards the end of the season, I didn't get enough time to really build up enough buzz and momentum for a call-up, and the season was over. And I decided to give it one more shot, and I went back to the D-League and pick up where I left off. And eventually in March of 2008, I was called the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Well, that's the next thing I want to talk about, of course, because against all of these odds that we have discussed and you have mentioned, you finally did make it to the NBA during a little slice of that 2007-2008 season. Tell us what that felt like.
Oh, it was wonderful. I enjoyed it. I was really impressed with just how professional Cleveland was, and they were very welcoming to me, and I loved it. I was grateful for the time that I had. You know, June came, and the draft came, and two big men fell into Cleveland's laps, and I kind of knew then that the writing was on the wall. But they decided to have me come to training camp in October of last year, and they decided to keep me there for about a week. And by then, it was too late for me to jump on with any other preseason roster in the NBA or take the good jobs overseas. And so I basically had to go back to the D-League. And you realize then, you know, it's just a business. You can't look for people to validate you, and that only you can validate yourself. And now, having finally seen the NBA and been there and seen what it's about, I can happily go back overseas to Italy or someplace where I have good jobs waiting for me next year if nothing pans out this offseason. I can just go to Italy and just play and have fun.
Lance Allred, who averaged 15 points and 9 rebounds for the Idaho Stampede last season, is the author of Long Shot, The Adventures of a Deaf Fundamentalist Mormon Kid and His Journey to the NBA. It's published by Harper. He joined me from the studios of KUER in Salt Lake City. Lance, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, no, thank you. Again, the pleasure was all mine.
My conversation with Lance Allred about his book, Long Shot, will be featured in this week's program. I'll also be talking with Brian Schmitz of the Orlando Sentinel about the magic Florida fans hope will prevail in the NBA Finals. We'll have a story about the Detroit Red Wings as well as they try to repeat as NHL champs. And Mr. Tennis, Bud Collins, will join me from the French Open, whether or not any of the favorites are still in the tournament. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.